From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Late Monday night, while all eyes were on the historic meeting of President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, the White House quietly released some documents. Among those documents were Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner's ethics disclosure forms. They were papers that showed the White House power couple made at least $82 million last year from their various business and investment dealings around the world. President Trump is an unusually wealthy man, yet his family business's activities while he's in office face sharp scrutiny and legal challenge. This hour, On Point, profits while in the White House. You can join us on air or online. Do you think the Trump family is exploiting its prominence and power for profit? Are you concerned about foreign governments and companies trying to influence the president by spending money at Trump Organization properties? Do you think such scrutiny merely punishes the Trump simply for having vast holdings? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter, Facebook, at onpointradio. Joining me now from Brooklyn, New York, is Adam Davidson, a staff writer for The New Yorker who has reported extensively about the Trump Organization's foreign business deals and potential conflicts of interest. He's also written a lot about the Mueller investigation. You can find links to several of his articles on our website, onpointradio.org. Adam, old friend, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, David. Great to be on with you.
So let's first start off with what's most recent, the disclosure forms about Ivanka and Jared, at least $82 million. It's worth pointing out that the way these disclosure forms are written, you know, I think they could have made as much as $222 million. It's a pretty broad range there. Are you surprised by the fact that in government they're making as much money as they did apparently in 2016 when they were not in government?
I would say like so much in this administration, it's simultaneously not at all surprising and completely and totally shocking.
They are.
It's not just that they're making so much money, and I think for most of us, $80 million in a year is an awful lot of money. It's the way they make money. So let's just, for the sake of argument, say they're not explicitly doing anything to, corrupt. I am not making that argument, but let's just say for the sake of argument that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
The way they make money is through, so Ivanka Trump makes it, a big chunk of her money comes directly from the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., also from the Trump Organization, from her clothing brand, all of which we now know are incredibly dependent on foreign governments, foreign officials, giving her trademarks, deciding whether or not to stay in that hotel. Jared Kushner's holdings that we know of are more domestic in that he owns an awful lot of real estate and gets money through those. But those also involve an awful lot of government. You know, real estate in America is as much a game of what economists call regulatory arbitrage. You're trying to figure out how to work with local and state zoning rules and real estate rules. So the way that local governments treat you is incredibly relevant to how profitable and wealthy
you are. These are things like zoning as to whether or not you're allowed to develop, whether you get tax incentives, whether or not you're allowed to get foreign investments, things like that.
Exactly. And then on top of it, like whether or not sort of the local officials are sort of signaling in a variety of ways that they'd rather have you be the developer of a project than someone else. So, and then lastly, he is getting a lot of money from overseas. We know that, you know, his company was saved by an investment from this Brookfield entity that has a lot of Gulf Arab money. And we know that, as far as we can tell, his father was courting directly several foreign governments that have direct interest in in U.S. foreign policy. They basically exist as an arm of U.S. foreign policy. So,
We may need a score sheet to keep track of all this. When you say the Gulf states, you're talking about places like Qatar, places around the Persian Gulf, places that are often oil and gas producing nations, right?
Yeah, for people who don't follow the Middle East closely, there is a massive realignment of geopolitical power and influence underway right now, and there's an explicit attempt for a Sunni Israeli alliance of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Israel, Egypt, sort of Sunni Arab states in Israel, and they are battling against a sort of Shia alliance, which, you know, obviously Iran being the main force there.
Right.
So you have.
But so you're saying that Charles Kushner, who was the developer who really made the helped really establish the family fortune for Jared Kushner, is going around and pumping or at least seeking investments in his family enterprises from some of these states, right?
So, I mean, he claims not. So he has repeatedly met with people who control the sovereign wealth funds, the piggy bank of these Gulf Arab states. And then he says, "Oh no, but I wasn't asking them for money." But it's almost worse if he wasn't. You know, why is the father of this powerful figure in the White House personally doing diplomacy with these foreign states? But clearly, this is unbelievably improper. So what I'm saying is, if they happen to not be doing anything corrupt, if there's no explicit quid pro quo, you know, yes, we will shift we will shift U.S. foreign policy if you give my dad $1 billion kind of thing.
Yeah, that would probably not a good way to go. But you're saying,
Let's say that didn't happen. The principle, the modern principle of ethics and government is not rooted in, boy, it'd be better if people don't explicitly act corruptly. It's to eliminate even the distraction. I mean, if the Folkenflik family fortune was tied up with decisions that the finance ministry of Qatar or Abu Dhabi makes.
And it's not.
Well, yes, the Folkenflik family fortune is so vast, it isn't controlled by any one country. But how can you have a meeting with Qatar without that being on your mind? I mean, just as a decent, we reporters know this, you know, business reporters like me, we don't own individual stocks.
I don't own
Coca-Cola because I might cover Coca-Cola and not want to be influenced. So how can you possibly not have that shade in a conscious or unconscious way the decisions you're making as a crucial government official?
So this has been an issue from the outset. Last year, 2017, Ivanka Trump sat down with Gayle King of CBS this morning. She said she fully divested from her business in order to take on a more senior role at the White House. Here's what she had to say.
With my husband taking such an influential role in the administration, I didn't want to also be running a business. So I put it into trust. I have independent trustees. I have no involvement in its management and its oversight and its strategic decision making.
But the trustees are family members, right? Your brother-in-law and your sister-in-law?
They are. They're completely independent, and I'm transparent about that.
So she says she's transparent about that.
To what extent? Too fine a point of this. That is a lie. She is lying.
Strong words, Adam Davidson.
She's worried about this. She is lying.
Why do you say that?
Because she's lying. She's revealing the lie in the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Divestment is, I no longer own those assets. I have nothing to do with those assets. I have no ability to benefit from those assets today or in the future. Ivanka Trump's assets are either branded Ivanka Trump or they are branded the Trump Organization. So right away, the assets are her. They are personal, you know, they are her personal brand. That's first of all. Second of all, the sort of Ronald Reagan trust but verify, Ivanka Trump and her father have put in zero. There is no mechanism to ensure that these are independent. So previous presidents who have had some wealth, or senators or others, will actually create true independent directors where they have zero influence. When it is a family member, family members you meet with regularly, that is not an independent director. That is a family member who knows your interests, who has a lot of avenues of communication with you. And then lastly, we know it's a lie because they have told us it's a lie. Eric Trump has said that he talks about the business with his dad all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We have people at the Trump Hotel saying that President Trump has been actively asking them questions about how's the food and beverage business going, how's this business going, who's signed up, who hasn't signed up. So they have done literally none of the steps, none of the very basic, well-practiced, well-known steps to truly
disentangle.
To disentangle in a way where they can make decisions where they have no ability to know how those decisions will affect their fortune.
And we'll get into some of the ethics things a bit down the line with somebody who's been there in the White House and understands how those rules work. I want to briefly turn to Debbie. She's calling from Stanton, Virginia. Go ahead, Debbie.
Hi, David.
Hiya.
Hey, I just think that all of this goodwill gesture towards North Korea is he sees an untapped real estate potential for him and his family after he leaves the White House.
We're talking about President Trump here.
Yeah, where he can develop a hotel and a resort and a golf course.
Thanks, Debbie, for that. Adam, in about the minute that we have at the end of this segment right now, to what extent is it worth looking at President Trump's public actions in light of his private holdings?
It is obvious. I think it is transparent.
Even North Korea. I mean, this isn't a place where people
expect to develop North Korean assets.
Say that again. You're saying that the President of the United States wants to develop assets in North Korea, a place to which very few tourists are desperate to go.
I mean, the watchword of this campaign is corruption. I mean, of this administration is corruption plus incompetence. So they have for many years made very bad and also very unethical business decisions quite often. So yes, I don't think if I had, $100 million to invest, my first choice would be North Korea resort properties. But that being said, there is no way to read his remarks yesterday as anything other than, wow, I could make a buck here, a big buck. And it would not shock me to hear that there was explicit discussion of that.
All right, Adam, we're gonna ask you to stand by. We want you to stay for the full hour. We are discussing the Trump Organization's foreign business practices and whether the First Family is taking advantage of its positions of power in order to turn a profit. You've been hearing there from Adam Davidson of The New Yorker. We'll be adding others. You can join the conversation yourself. What do you make of the First Family's financial gains while serving the country? Do you agree with Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff's concerns? The administration's policies may at times be driven by the Trump family's financial interests rather than the best interests of the country. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about concerns about pay-for-play at the White House and recent revelations that the president's daughter and son raked in at least $82 million last year from their business dealings and investments. Given the way those forms are written, it's important to point out they may have made as much as $222 million. You can join the conversations. Are you staying at Trump hotels, picking up items from Ivanka Trump's fashion brands, boycotting them? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is The New Yorker staff writer Adam Davidson. I'd like to bring in another voice right now as well. Joining me from the nation's capital is Washington Post reporter Jonathan O'Connell. He covers economic development and focuses on commercial real estate and the Trump Organization, and was part of a reporting team that staked out the Trump International Hotel near the White House and documented the influential cast of characters coming through its doors. Jonathan, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, David.
So, Jonathan, Adams has mentioned the resorts and the role they play. Tell us what it's like watching the ebb and flow. Who comes in and out of those hotels, and what it really signifies for the Trump Organization, the Trump family, and for its fortunes.
Sure. I mean, I think the Washington Hotel stands out from the other properties the family has, just because it's such an easy way to connect the influence that the family has with the president's position with a money-making venture. So if you go in the hotel any night of the week, you can see members of the administration. You can see Republican fundraisers. You can see lobbying groups who are there. And there are also just, of course, fans of Trump and business groups. The hotel, more than any other business that the Trump family has, is really geared to profit off the political situation that we're in right now. And that's, I think, what makes it so outrageous for a lot of people.
Tell me what you mean by that. It's geared to profit off things right now. Why right now?
Right. So, if you go to a lot of luxury hotels in Washington, you get a really kind of broad mix of people doing business there, right? So you have, you'll have weddings, you'll have associations, you'll have, work parties, and then, big events for embassies, et cetera. In the Trump Hotel, you get a very specific few categories of groups that do a lot of business there. So Republican groups or conservative groups do a ton of business there. Religious groups do a ton of business there. Lobbying and business groups do a ton of business there. And then people who are either sort of supportive of Trump or maybe have some connection to Trump or the White House are there a lot. It's a very unique and kind of bizarre world actually because the politics shapes so much of who does business there.
I want to play a clip. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe stayed at President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort last year. Trump said it wasn't a conflict of interest because he was footing the prime minister's bill. Ethics specialist Kathleen Clark talked to my NPR colleague Steve Inskeep. She said it wasn't just about the cost of the hotel room.
Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago establishment is a commercial establishment, and he has a financial interest in promoting that business.
Oh, this is publicity. The
free
fact
publicity.
That everybody in the world, every media organization in the world is going to mention Mar-a-Lago because the Japanese prime minister is there with the president.
It's product placement.
It's product placement, she says. Jonathan O'Connell, how different would the volume of traffic be from lobbyists and world leaders and the like if Donald Trump had lost in November, I should say, of 2016, or if Donald Trump had never been the nominee at all?
Oh, that's an interesting hypothetical. I mean, I think that the business would be doing a lot different things than they're doing now. I think they would be probably expanding much more quickly than they are. I mean, they had plans to do a number of different foreign deals that are not, as far as we know anyway, active. And they had, they have announced obviously plans to do two different hotel chains in America, Scion and American Idea, at sort of different price points. And that really hasn't taken off either. What's happened instead is you have obviously some people are avoiding their properties and not staying at them probably because of politics. And you can see in some golf courses and hotels that that has hurt their properties and that their name has come off other properties because the owners or the condo owners just are not going to have it anymore and they think their values are being hurt, et cetera. If he had not become president, I think they would still be profiting off the way that he publicized his name and how famous he became during the campaign. I just think it would look different.
Adam Davidson, we've got a posting on Facebook on our site from a listener named Jeffrey Radu, I believe it is. Forgive me, Jeffrey, if I've mispronounced that. He says, dumb discussion. The left would only be happy if they could totally destroy Trump financially. Never mind both Clinton and Obama made millions while in office. And from what we're hearing from Jonathan, maybe the Trumps could have done more expansion. Maybe their business would have flourished to a greater degree had he not taken office. Their supporters would say they've made some sacrifices to have this job. What about that argument?
So, I mean, I would break it down into pieces. I do personally, I will say, find it objectionable that it's now an expectation that a former president will make, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars through book deals and speeches. I don't think that's illegal, but it is unseemly, and I think,
and even while in office, I think presidents can make monies from. I think the precedent on books is that people are allowed to take money. No,
yes. I mean, what Donald Trump told us is that his understanding is that he can run his business fully. That there's no legal problem. So yes, I completely agree that it is unseemly for anyone to use their political office to get rich. I think I don't like that Barack Obama, has made so much money through book deals and through speeches. I don't like that the Clintons have. I don't like that So I agree, but that is not, that is not a relevant comparison in my view. The Trump Organization's core business has been, first of all, it's much, much bigger. Second of all, it's much, much more directly dependent on the interests of government officials in other countries, regional, local government officials in the United States. And and the Trump Organization has avoided forever, for decades, the ethical and legal framework that ensures a business is not conducting corruption. I mean, just as one example, the Taj Mahal casino was, for its entire 15-year existence under Trump, in violation of anti-money laundering laws, receiving at the time the largest fine ever for anti-money laundering violations. His business in Azerbaijan, which I've written about, was actively in business with a company that the Trump Organization has admitted they know was laundering money for Iran's Revolutionary Guard. So I think that we can live in a world where a lot of people do a lot of unseemly things, and this is unprecedented. But lastly, and sorry to go on so long, I would say that as an American citizen, it's not important to me to make sure that Republicans are held to the same standards as Democrats or whatever. Sure, that seems like a reasonable goal. But it is important to me to know that when the president and his top advisors are making major decisions that impact U.S. foreign policy, U.S. domestic policy, that they are in no way focusing those decisions based on how they themselves will profit. I don't see how you argue that Obama's book doing pretty well while he's in office is changing his foreign policy.
Jonathan O'Connell, I wanted to play a little bit of tape from Jerry Nadler, who's a Democrat, a New York congressman. He's one of nearly 200 Democrats from Congress who's suing President Trump on the basis of the president's foreign business deals. He says it violates a clause of the Constitution that we'll talk about a little bit later in the hour. But I did want to hear what he had to say because it I think crystallizes or gives an example of crystallizing this concern about the president's motivations.
When the president suddenly shows a solicitude for the Chinese company ZTE, is that because Xi Jinping persuaded the president that to do so was in the best interest of the United States? Or was that because the Chinese government granted intellectual property and trademarks to the president's companies or his family?
Obviously, Jonathan O'Connell, our dealings with China are really important for our own reason. We've talked about possible trade war. They're a key player in the question of security in North Korea. And yet here is an element where the president is trying to figure out, is there a way to bring this company back? Can you unpack for listeners a little bit behind that controversy and where the president is on that?
Sure. I mean, Nadler is one of the 200 Democrats in Congress who are suing the president over, as you said, his foreign business deals and particularly the money that he receives from, embassies at his hotel, investors in his properties, et cetera. You know, when you talk about China, I think another thing to keep in mind here that is really important if you're a real estate developer is China is a huge investor in real estate, and they are a big buyer of hotels in America. They're a big buyer in just, they're investors in major commercial real estate in America and elsewhere. And if you're the Trump family, that would be a really, really great, partner to have down the road. And if there's anything you can do while you're in the White House that maybe, eases that relationship after you get out or, down the road, I can see why people would be really upset about that because that's probably not a conversation the Trumps could have if they were not in the White House and if they were not in political power. So that's the reason I think that a lot of these court cases that are focused on the Constitutional Emolument Clause really raise people's concerns because the foreign influence that potentially some of these companies or countries may have while Trump is president and is maybe thinking about his businesses is really a kind of an immediate concern.
You've just been hearing there from Jonathan O'Connell. He's a reporter for The Washington Post. You can find a link to his latest piece. Trump can profit from foreign government business at his hotel if he doesn't do favors in return, Justice Department says. At our website, that's onpointradio.org. Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
I want to take a call briefly from Anna. She's calling in from Rutland, Vermont. Anna, go ahead.
Hi, David.
Hiya.
I am calling, this is Anna in Vermont, because I think that all the negative publicity that Trump is getting, it's hurting. I think it hurts his company and his daughter's company. I don't think it's helping. I think that just the other day, I saw the president of the United States shake the hand of the North Korean leader. That was unbelievable. And I hear nothing about it. I hear nothing from NPR or anyone.
Well, Anna, let me offer you this.
He's getting the deserved credit that he has earned.
He's not – well, and Anna, I appreciate that. He's not getting the credit that he deserves, that according to our listener Anna from Rutland, Vermont. I appreciate the point, although I will say this week I spent a full hour on the very question of North Korea and that meeting. I do want to bring in a voice who can offer perhaps some perspective about why this might matter. And he knows a thing or two about ethics in the White House. His name is Norm Eisen. Norm served as White House ethics czar for the Obama administration. He's currently a senior fellow over at the Brookings Institution in Governance Studies. You can find a link to the New York Times op-ed he published and co-wrote yesterday titled "Will Congress Block Trump's Deal with a Dangerous Company?" at our website. That's onpointradio.org. Norm, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, David. Very pleased to be back.
I wanted to let you frame for us why this stuff matters. Presidents, you know, are prominent people. Most of them have come up one way or another through government. Some of them have had business interests, including George H.W. Bush, including George W. Bush, but not only them. Some have profited from books they've done in office. The president seems to be day-to-day focusing on his job or on social media. Take your pick. Tell us why this stuff matters.
The president is also spending third of his days in office at his own properties, a quarter of his days on one of his golf courses, and he's relentlessly using the Oval Office in a way we have never before seen. Never in American history have we seen anything like a running infomercial for Donald Trump and his family being conducted in the Oval Office, the White House, and in the presidency. And it's something that we see the locus of it is the Trump Hotel, where there's this toxic cocktail that's served in the Trump Hotel bar. Of special interest influence, where you have domestic and foreign influencers who have powerful concerns with the United States, whether it's states who want things from the president, foreign governments around the world who go there. But it's not limited to that, David. It's all this is happening all over the United States and all over the planet. And here's why it matters. The founders of our country and the framers of our Constitution were so concerned about just this scenario that you'd have foreign governments giving cash or other benefits to a president to try to bend his influence, or the states in the United States
doesn't
doing
matter.
The same Does the it, same thing.
Does it matter whether
they
or not
put it in the Constitution?
Sure. And I want to in a few minutes, I want to talk about the constitutional issues. But does it matter whether or not we can prove that that's why the Chinese may have done something? That's why the Qataris, Gulf State emirs and their families may have invested in the president's son-in-law's family's company. It doesn't matter whether or not we can draw that connection that explicitly.
Well, I think that when you look at the pattern, and Adam and Jonathan discussed it with you, you can draw some inferences from the pattern. Do we really believe that it's a coincidence that the Trump family benefits from a $500 million investment in a project that they're involved in Indonesia? They're described by the project promoters as partners in that. The president has a personal interest in that because he's hung on to his businesses, unlike every president before him in the modern era, Democrat and Republican. And then a short time later, this bizarre deal is done to preserve a Chinese telecom company that's been sanctioned because it's a threat to United States national security interests. And then China throws in new trademarks for Ivanka Trump to boot. I think it's fair for us to draw some inferences from the timing of that kind of thing. And it happens again and again all over the world, whether it's the Gulf princes giving benefits to the Trump family and Trump taking sides in the Gulf in a way that we haven't seen in an administration before, whether it's the financial dealings involving Ivanka and Jared that we've also written about. Yes, I think some inferences are fair. Are they conclusive? No.
All right. Well, we're going to pick
they
all
matter.
We're going to pick all this up. Norma Eisen, Adam Davidson. We want to also point out we've reached out both to the White House and to representatives of Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, and they decided not to participate in this. Ivanka and Jared's representative pointing out that this is consistent with the kind of money they made the year before they joined the White House. You can join our conversation. Is it possible for the president to maintain a stake in his business empire without creating a conflict of interest? And what of Congress's role? I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. Today we're talking about concerns over the president and his family and whether they're profiting from their prominent positions in power. You can join the conversation. Should all politicians be required by law to disclose their tax forms and potential conflicts of interest? Should those laws apply to their staff? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Adam Davidson. He's staff writer for The New Yorker. And Norm Eisen, former White House ethics czar for the Obama administration. You know, there's literally news coming in just now being posted by The Washington Post. David Farenthold has been tweeting a bit about it this morning, I believe, that the state attorney general of New York, Barbara Underwood, has filed a lawsuit alleging that the Donald J. Trump Foundation, the president's nonprofit charity, engaged in illegal conduct. The suit accuses POTUS, the president of the United States, and his three eldest children of using the nonprofit to pay off business creditors, decorate one of his golf clubs, and even stage a multi-million dollar giveaway at his 2016 campaign events. The intermingling of things. I hear Norm Eisen sighing there. Tell me your thoughts on what we're learning from the Washington Post this morning.
History of Donald Trump is one in which he has pushed the envelope legally and ethically to the breaking point, often beyond civil and regulatory red lines. So far, he's managed to avoid criminal liability. We'll see if that continues. The foundation is an example of this. It has existed, and my watchdog group that I chair, CRU, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, was a leader in helping to unearth this information in 2016. It has operated contrary to what charities are supposed to do. It's operated to benefit Donald Trump. It hasn't complied with legal requirements. In other words, it's been a sham. So
people may say, listen, he's untidy. We've known that. He got in legal entanglements before he came into office. We've read about it one way or another in headlines for years. Ultimately, you know, his supporters will say people know that. They've absorbed it. They've to some degree discounted it. Why does that matter?
David, can I jump in?
Okay. Adam Davidson, The New Yorker. Go ahead, buddy.
Yeah, so a lot of prominent economists, historians, and some of them Republican or not especially political, are extremely anxious at this moment in time. And I'll tell you why all of this feels, not just is it fair or should Trump go to jail or is it gross or whatever, but truly terrifying to people who have a view of how governments work, how economies work. There is a phrase in economics called a rentier state. A rentier state is one in which, if you look at America, how does the government exist? It's because there is a platform of institutions, freedom, democracy, courts that you can rely on, not to mention roads and electricity and other things, that allow all of us to do work, to come up with companies, to do our jobs, make money, pay taxes, that taxes goes to the government works for us. A rentier state is one like Iraq or Saudi Arabia or Venezuela, where the government makes money from oil or from diamonds or from some other asset that the people don't generate. The government has control over it. And then the government doesn't need the people. The government isn't accountable to the people. And rentier states are always corrupt, dangerous, unstable, violent, terrifying places. They're wildly unequal. They have deep poverty, And President Trump is rentierifying America. When he is signaling again and again and again that the presidency is a path to wealth, and that the presidency and the rules of the government, even before he was president, such as how to run a charity, are not tools to serve the overall purpose of a prosperous democracy, but tools to transfer wealth from the country to the person in power. That is deeply, deeply terrifying. So
you're not saying that
for Norm, the greatest fear is not so much that he's doing it; it's that there is so little concern about him doing it.
Fascinating. Look, one of the things I want to get to is the question of ways in which people believe, at least his critics believe, enrichment occurs. Last summer, after President Trump held his first reelection fundraiser at his international hotel in D.C., the one we've been talking about, that was an event that was expected to raise $10 million. A Democratic member of the what's called the House Oversight Committee, Jerry Connolly, went on CNN. He questioned not only the legality of holding the fundraiser there, but of the lease that Trump has for the hotel itself.
His whole relationship with the Trump Hotel becomes a massive conflict of interest the day he was sworn in. The lease agreement with the federal government is crystal clear that an elected official cannot be participating in that lease or benefiting from it.
And I think this gets to, in some ways, the question, the constitutional question raised. And there's a federal lawsuit right now filed by chief lawyers for the District of Columbia and the state of Maryland against the president, who say that the president's profits from the hotel violate anti-corruption clause of the Constitution. It's called emoluments. I'm going to hope that none of us use the word again this hour. But nonetheless, this is not a trivial thing. It's just not really a tested thing. Norm Eisen, you've been involved in this. You've obviously are a deep critic of the president. But tell us what constitutional element there is here that you think the president is either coming close to or stepping across.
Sure, David. I personally and crew, my watchdog, are co-counsel with the Maryland and D.C. attorneys general in this case. And it goes to Adam's point, actually, because the founders of our country and the framers of the Constitution were so worried that a president would take office and then would use that office to align his own pockets at the expense. This is the common theme. It's at the expense of the American people instead of worrying about jobs and education and the health of the American people, that he would use those opportunities for self-gain. They put it in the Constitution. I won't say emoluments, just the modern-day translation is swag. No swag from foreign governments, no cash or other benefits from foreign governments or domestic ones, because we don't want the president preferring one state over another, are allowed in the Constitution. And there's no intent test. David, we talked about this earlier. How do we prove it? They were so worried about this. They knew it was so hard to prove up those inferences, and such a danger to have this exploitation with the enormous power of the presidency. And they'd seen it happen in their day with King Charles of England being in the pay of the French Bourbon throne, and the way that distorted British foreign policy, that they put this into the Constitution. And that's what this lawsuit and the other parallel ones around the country are about. The hard part of the lawsuits is getting standing. And D.C. and Maryland got standing. They proved to the Maryland federal court, yes, we have an injury. We just last
right,
week
standing,
had an
standing
argument.
Being the idea that somehow they've been harmed and therefore they have the right to file a lawsuit about this.
You've got to prove that harm, that injury, in order to get into federal court. Otherwise, the courts would be like Congress. They'd be a field for political disputes. You got to show actual harm. Maryland and D.C. prove that. We helped as co-counsel. And then We've just had a hearing. It followed on a hearing in the congressional case. In our case, we've just had a hearing about the scope of the Emoluments Clause, just the thing that you referred to, David. What does that term mean? And we are arguing—
And this is kind of being hashed out, though, because this is not something that's been brought against presidents in the modern era. You know, if you got to go back to the Bourbon, I don't know that the anti-Bourbon caucus in Congress is so large that they're going to rise up against the president. But, you know, this is something that really has to be, in some ways, hashed out. I want to go quickly to a call from here in Boston, Massachusetts. Keith, tell us your concerns.
Hi, David. Well, I'm concerned, even apart from the corruption angle, the fact that Donald Trump says that, you know, I can run both. I can run the Trump Organization as well as the country. I feel like if he's devoting even 1 minute of his time to his companies, that's time he's not spending running the country. We elected him to be president. You know, he ran for president. If he wants the job, he should do the job. Otherwise, it's a dereliction of that duty.
So thank you, Keith, for that. We obviously offered the opportunity for spokespeople for the White House and also for representatives of Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump to participate in this show. They declined. But we did hear, you know, and this is going back to the very beginning, we heard from one of President Trump's lawyers, Sherry Dillon, back in January of 2017 at a famous press conference. She's waved to a huge stack of documents that she said should comfort people. But she also said the president has gone out of his way to distance himself from his companies, even though she argues that as a legal matter, standard rules don't apply to the president of the United States.
The conflicts of interest laws simply do not apply to the president or the vice president, and they are not required to separate themselves from their financial assets.
Norm Eisen, if this argument had been made on behalf of a Democratic president, you know, it does seem as though some of the laws do not apply to elected officials. What would you have made? What do you make of this statement? What would you have made of it if President Obama's lawyers had said this to you?
Well, I was President Obama's lawyer for his big emoluments, his foreign issue, which we worked out, his Nobel Prize. And we did not, in consultation, I was working as the ethics czar, as the special counsel in the White House at the time, we did not allow the president to accept the cash that comes with the Nobel Prize.
Six figures, right?
Indeed. Sherry, it might have even been a little more than that at the time. Sherry Dillon was wrong because first of all, there are some statutory and regulatory requirements that do apply even to a president, but she ignored the constitutional limitations that you can't get what the president is getting by hanging on to his businesses, which are these flows of cash from all of the most conflicted countries where we have the strongest interests and relationships all over the world, the Gulf, India, China, the Philippines. These are our most critical and problematic foreign relationships. It is against the Constitution. And so that was totally wrong. I will add, David, that I think that was only the second most famous press conference that day, because at the Brookings Institution, the Bush ethics czar, Richard Painter, and I hosted head of the Office of Government Ethics, Walt Schaub, who denounced the president's plans as a break with bipartisan tradition. And that really set the frame for the country being concerned and focused with this. The American people did not have a referendum saying Donald Trump could raid the presidency to line his pockets and that of his family to the harm of the country and to damaging people's interests, as our caller pointed out. They wanted him to do the job. So that's why this issue has really stuck. And it's only going to get worse.
And no, David, can I just interject?
Please.
This was the only and most important official statement of the president and his representatives. He is explicitly saying that I can't be corrupt because my technical reading of the law is that I can enrich myself, and it isn't technically corruption. And that is the only—I mean, I think that people give the president a deference as if he behaved like a normal president would, and as if he has said, I won't be corrupt. He has said, I will be corrupt, by anyone but his and Sherry Dillon's definition of corruption. I would also say that legally or not, I mean, you and I, David, are journalists, and we are ethical journalists, at least I am, and I do not take money from people I cover. I do not put myself in any position where there anyone could even suggest I might make money off of someone I cover. Like I said, I don't own Apple stock. I don't own Microsoft stock because I might cover them, even if all I would own is a few, you know, a few hundred dollars worth or something. And it's not because that's the law. It's because I take the responsibility of my role seriously. The president has explicitly said he doesn't. He's saying, catch me if you can, and I don't think the law applies. That is terrifying.
Adam, I want to ask you, you've covered, we've only got a couple minutes left, really a minute left for this, but you've covered so much in Eastern Europe, the state of Georgia, the European state of Georgia, I should say, and the Trump family's investments there. How much do you think the concern about the Trump administration about the inquiry that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is doing has to do with their business interests as opposed to questions simply surrounding the election?
I think that there is an unbelievable amount of money that the Trump Organization has made through people extremely close to Vladimir Putin, and that will be central to the Robert Mueller's investigation. And it is shocking. I mean, the President of the United States, for the entire campaign, was in business with a known Kremlin ally who was also laundering money for Iran's Revolutionary Guard. And he knew it. He admitted he knew it. It's unbelievable.
Well, we live in a time of miracles and a time of wonders and a time of shock in some ways. You've just been hearing the voice of Adam Davidson. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker who has written extensively about the Trump Organization's foreign business holdings as well as recent investigations. Adam, always a pleasure.
Great to talk to you.
And you've also heard from Norm Eisen. He served as White House ethics czar for the Obama administration and is currently a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. I guess with those dueling press conferences, you're engaging what we call counter-programming here in radio. Norm, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, David.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Jeremy Rolosa, James Ross, Grace Tatter, Gretchen Voss, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Carolyn Anders. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.